The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, welcome to MotoGP OD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. My name is Jules Cisek. I'm here with Jim Race. We're at episode 195, and it's Friday, September 18.
We're like right on the cusp of 200.
We're getting close.
That'd be cool.
Yep. Well, there was no racing this week, so we're going to keep it fairly short. I did have a very nice chat with Adam Silver, who was at the Donington, and he talks about Day of Champions. We'll put that at the end of the show. He also talks about some of the racing and just the weekend in general. It's a really nice chat. We chatted about that while we were at Laguna Seca on Friday, which we'll have to talk about a little later. What else are we going
to
talk about?
Even when we end up in a break, there's still a lot of things to talk about. So there's still a bunch of silly season stuff going on. There are rumors, weird little gaps in the points. And so, you know, it's not a blank point in time.
No. Yeah, I know. I'm just, I was being facetious.
All right.
Okay, we'll start off with some listener email. Joshua Davis wrote in about Moto 2, and this is what he had to say. He said, will the 600cc class completely sever the link between superbikes and MotoGP? Hear me out. In my opinion, the path to becoming a MotoGP rider will now be through the supersport class. Think about it. Spend a year or two riding WSS. Maybe you win a championship, move up to a Moto2 ride, then step up to MotoGP. If this is really the case, it seems like the superbike class will even more become the class for outcasts and guys who couldn't quite cut it in MotoGP, but are too good to throw away. Thoughts? It's an interesting point. I don't really see it that way because I think that the most natural path is still going to be through the supporting class, the 125s going with 125 riders and whatever that class becomes eventually, moving up to Moto 2, simply because they actually, you know, go to the same tracks and work with the same people and all the handshakes happen, you know, in the paddock mostly. So
I think it's kind of a yes and no thing. I mean, for those people that follow the series closely, it's a pretty well-known fact that the World Superbike and MotoGP paddocks are like massively different. You know, one is World Superbike is like a big family to some extent, and the MotoGP paddock, while it is kind of like that, is much more regimented. But regardless, you know, and they don't all run the same tracks. There are quite a few that are different, but the thing that has really kind of shaken everything up this year and thrown the entire progression platform into a blender is Moto 2. You know, where do people go? Who knows?
Well, I mean, I think that's Joshua's point, is that it does throw things up in the air, and I agree with that. However, I'm not quite sure if it's going to, you know, bleed riders incoming into World Superbikes quite so badly where it becomes a real outcast. And I don't even necessarily agree with that. I think there's some riders that just simply thrive better when they don't have to twiddle too much with the bike. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. So as the racing world, tilts over to four strokes, as much as you and I might not be very pleased with that. And of course, our listeners and a whole lot of other, you know, racing devotees across the world, it is kind of leaning that way. And as it does, that is kind of the way that we're going to have to deal with things. How racers and teams deal with that, and especially this year, this coming up year, you know, you've got 42 teams coming in to Moto 2. You've got a whole bunch of 250 teams that are going to be probably, you know, left stranded on an island somewhere. And you've got a lot of guys that are going to be moving from, I don't think outcast is the proper word to use. So I'll like ping.
Well, that's my point. My point is that, that Superbikes are, not simpler necessarily to set up, but they are. But there's a lot less going on in terms of, like, basically you get on and ride a lot more than you do with a MotoGP bike, and the development level is the requirement for development level skills is much lower, which means that you have a much wider variety of riders that can ride fast right from the get go.
If I had to guess, I would say that if you were to step down to the superbike class, and this is a guess, and nobody hate me for this, but I would have to say that the superbike level actually requires more out of a team from a development level than from a rider. A GP bike is configurable to pretty much any spec that the rider can request. You know, you've got, you know, crazy swing arm bearings. You've got multiple stuff in the steering head, and there's a lot that you can't do on a World Superbike class machine. And more team, maybe more teamwork. I mean, you know, there's no Jeremy Burgesses, and people are saying I'm starting to fall in love with him, but he's a little bit old for me. Yeah, you're right. It is a different machine, and I think the team matters more in that series than it does probably with exception of the very top tier in the Untouchable Four in the GP series.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and I think there's plenty of proof for that, because you can look at, like, you know, Hanspree, and the number of riders that went through there, and they all did pretty well, except I guess for Sofoglu, who had a bit of an issue with it, with the superbike, and went back to super sports. But
so yeah, thanks for that, Joshua. Appreciate the email.
Yeah, it's very, very thoughtful. Okay, so let's talk about what do you want to talk about next? You want to talk about Sears?
Yeah. It's kind of cool. A friend of mine, Chris, invited me out to Sears Point this weekend. So if any of you folks want to come out, if any of you folks are in California and you can make it up to Sears Point, California, or Infineon as it's known now, this weekend, try and track me down. I'll probably be wearing a MotoGP OD t-shirt and walking around the pits at least on Saturday, I'm Sunday. And hopefully I'll drag you out there as well. You want to come up?
Yeah, I'm going to try. Definitely.
Cool.
So you have a friend that's racing?
Yeah, Justin Lowitz. He's kind of an up-and-comer, young gun, and we'll have to see how he does. He's had some great results up in the Northwest, so we'll have to see how it goes.
Cool.
Excellent.
Yeah. This is AFM, by the way, not AMA. That's a local series that runs at four tracks in California?
Three, but it's a club that is it's over 50 years old and has provided a couple of names like Kenny Roberts and a couple of people you might recognize over the years. So brilliant club. But, yeah, it's local. I mean, you know, how can I – promote this without, you know, to people in Sweden?
Probably not very well. And you used to race in the AFM for how many years?
I raced there for 5 years, and I'm under incredible pressure to race there again next year, and I'm working on my bike, so I think I'll be back.
I've actually noticed that there was a bunch of Twitters from you tweets, I should say, where you're like, oh, I got this part and I'm doing this. I'm like, oh, he's putting his bike back together. Sweet.
Yeah, well, I need to have a backup motor and yanked out the modified shift linkage and threw in the Ohlins unit. So, yeah, not quite at Formula 50 yet, but we'll see how it works out.
Nice. Okay. So in the news, MotoGP news, we had, well, first of all, let's play this little clip that Len Padilla sent. The fans that Moto.GP guy, he actually sent this in like 2 weeks ago. We just never had a chance to play it, but he tells us exactly how to pronounce Aleix Espargaró. So here we go.
Hey, Jules. Hi, Jim. Aleix Espargaró is how you say his name. Aleix is the Catalan version of the name Alejo, a name that we don't really have a translation for.
All right, so that's how you say it. Thanks, Len.
You know, it's interesting that he points that out, and thanks, Len, for that. There's kind of a weird little thing going on because, you know, Canepa has not had the best season so far, and Espargaró came in and
immediately was decent.
Yeah, dude was on fire. And so now there is word that Pramac has offered him a contract, or maybe not a contract, but an offer for the rest of the season while Canepa is still in contract. So, which is odd. And then, and Canepa's been a test writer for a long time for Ducati, right?
Yep.
And, you know, he did the writing, you know, he's had like probably the best Mugello times, you know, right up there with the rest of the guys. And, but he's fighting back, understandably, but he may end up sitting out the rest of the season while Espargaró rides, but he's still going to get paid. So it's weird.
I think they have to honor that contract, but they want Espargaró because he may very well be a new Ducati guy that actually knows how to ride a GP10, you know, when we get there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't believe this is actually a grasping at straws thing that Ducati is doing. I think the Pramac team is actually wise to pick somebody that can step on the bike or pop on the bike and go quick fast. And you know, I've been bitching about Tomasi's performance for the last few weeks, and when you see somebody like Espargaró just hop on the bike and immediately go quick, it's very impressive.
Yeah, and it's a difficult bike too, and we know that the bike that Tomasi and Takahashi rode is capable of doing much better, because last year Dovizioso was doing incredible things with that. Now, granted, many things have changed since last year. For one thing, last year Team Scott was running on Michelins, and maybe they didn't quite gel with the Bridgestones as well as some of the other Hondas. But yeah, it's kind of a shame to see both Yuki Takahashi. I mean, he obviously did bad enough where he got replaced with Tomasi, and Tomasi is not doing so well either. And here comes Espargaró, like, you know, first time out he beat Tomasi, second time out he beat Tomasi. So yeah, impressive.
And so this is not a slight on Nico Canepa. The guy has done a great job for what he's had available to him. He's had some okay results this season, and I think that he deserves props for what he's done with the package that he has. I think he probably got thrown into the deep end a little bit quick. And I think in perhaps the Moto2 series or elsewhere, he'd be a fantastic rider and could finish up at the front.
Well, he's done well in super sports.
Absolutely.
So I think you're right. I think he does. I mean, he's obviously, you know, he's not that weak.
not at all. He's a big kid is what he is.
Mm-hmm.
So
I have to say that there's been a couple of races where I thought he just was basically circulating. And I accused Melandri of that when we were talking last week. Last year, I think at some point the Ducati just beat him up so much that he really just started giving up. And you know, when your heart's not in it, you know, why would you risk your limbs and whatever if you're not going to get good results, and you know you're not going to get good results, and in the sense of the confidence. If you don't have the confidence, then you know.
Yeah, I mean,
it's over.
If you've ever ridden a race bike at 10 tenths and it is not giving you the feedback that you want, and whether that's through your own input or what you have been handed, there's nothing you can do. You cannot go beyond that without tossing the bike down the road. And if you're back in 13, 14, 15 place, there's no point in binning it. Because that'd be even more humiliating than, you know, only coming home with 1 point. No fun.
Right,
fun.
Right, Right. But, yeah, but anyway, he's definitely going to get paid to the end of the season because the guy's not going to break a contract and get themselves in those trouble over this. But that doesn't mean that they can't just have him sit it out and see what happens with Aleix Espargaró.
Well, yeah, considering the track record of the Pramac team over the last couple of races of the year, it might be nice to have a guy hanging in the wings, you know what I mean?
Yep. Yep.
All right, so moving on. You know, this is an interesting thing, and it was all credit to Neil F. from the MotoGP News Forum, and it didn't even occur to me because you think about the top four, right?
Especially this year.
Yeah, and those are the people you think about. Although there is kind of a top five surfacing, but clearly the top two are Rossi and Lorenzo. But there's a huge battle at the middle of the field that we don't have a real handle on, and the gap is so tight, and it could change massively. We still got a bunch of races left.
Yep.
And you're looking. So I'm going to run down through this real quickly. 8th through 14th, separated by 15 points. Scandalous, Depunier, Landry, Vermeulen, Elias, Tozlin, and Hayden. And why does that matter? Well, when you're looking at contracts, when you're looking at signing, when you're looking at trying to figure out what your quote-unquote number is for next year to actually put on that dotted line, being in the top 10 makes a huge difference. And that tiny little gap, which can change, you can look at Nicky Hayden, who's currently in 14th, and with one race, he could be all the way up in 8th, or vice versa, knock De Angelis down, which I wouldn't mind doing with his 2D-free helmet.
Well, I mean, right now, the most amazing thing, I think, is the fight inside the 10th place, which is De Angelis, Depunier, Melandri, just a point apart.
Absolutely.
And they're not that far away from Caparossi either. I mean, if one bad race for Caparossi could bring him into the clutches of those guys. So yeah, this is a very interesting point. Very interesting.
Yeah. So that will be fun to watch over the rest of the year. I think I say the rest of the year, but frankly, every race weekend kind of stirs things up, and we'll be like, oh well, that was something that we probably shouldn't have talked about, but. I think it's those of you that have anybody can go to MotoGP.com and look at the stats and look at the current standings, but it is kind of weird in the very middle of the pack. The guys at the top, Rossi currently has a 30-point lead, which is solid over Lorenzo. Pedrosa's, a full
50 points back.
Yeah, 50 points back, and obviously Stoner, who will be back shortly. That'll be crazy, won't it? What are we going to do with that?
We're going to watch. We're going to enjoy, hopefully. Yeah.
We should start speculating on that next week. So it'll be interesting to see how that shakes out. And it will make a difference when it comes to contract negotiations, either, Moto2, MotoGP, World Superbike, wherever these guys land. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, and this really brings home the point of why Hayden, who normally does not get very upset, was very upset last time out of Misano when he got taken out by De Angelis, because for the guys who are actually in that mix, they're very, very aware of where they are. Like, we might just go, oh, look, well, that's interesting. Those guys are extremely aware of where their standings are, and Nicky Hayden does not want to be 14th. You know, he wants to be in the top 10. And he's just starting to gel with the bike. He had really good lap times, all of that, Misano, and it was a shame that he didn't get to finish. And Edwards, I don't think we really just underline just how incredible it is if he did finish 5th, because it's not just that he would be the top privateer or satellite team, because you can't really call them privateers. It would be that he would be the best of the rest, because Everybody's talking about the top four guys, Rossi, Lorenzo, Pedrosa, Stoner being just completely above everybody else. Well, then who's the best of the rest would be it would have been Edwards if it wasn't for Misano. Now Dovizioso has jumped ahead. And, you know, Dovizioso is a great racer, and he's had his share of bad luck, too, this year. So I think he deserves the spot he's in, but it would be pretty damn amazing if Edwards was able to finish ahead of him by the end of the year. That's going to be another one to watch. They're only 10 points apart.
I want to see Colin take his big old T-shirt and, like, knock Dovian's ass.
Oh, man. Okay, well, not much else to talk about in MotoGP, so just quickly, I just wanted to talk about Laguna Seca. It was the first time I've ever been to Laguna Seca for a track day on Friday. It was also the, I don't know how long since there was a track day at Laguna that had a no noise restriction. So there were a lot of people out there with some very interesting machines, and nobody had to put on, you know, DB killers or any of that crap. And and I found out that the real reason was that this was originally scheduled to be an AMA weekend, and something got messed up in there. And then so they did bikes on Friday, and I think there were cars on Saturday and Sunday.
Right. So tell me how loud it was.
What's that?
Tell me how loud it was.
It was, I mean, you know, it was like any other track day. But you know, like Laguna Seca... I mean, the only times I've ever been to Laguna Seca is for racing, so it's really loud. So yeah, I mean, one of the cool things was that the quality of people that were out there was amazing. Like it wasn't like, you know, a bunch of guys with trailers that showed up. It was, you know, the full setups, the tents, so if you stood in the paddock on if you went up the stairs over the garages, it looked like a race weekend.
So you sent me a text telling me that there were six D16s out there.
Yeah, there were Desmos Adichis. There were three sitting under one tent, and there were there was one actually that was in the A group, which is interesting, because most of the time I don't think anybody would want to run at that pace with a $70,000 motorcycle. But
I would, raising hand.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a shame that they don't, but I understand why somebody might not.
Yeah, a fairing on one of those things is like 15K, so.
And actually, one guy did drop his RR, and he dropped it in the paddock, which was really sad.
Yeah, I think I'd like, that's when you need a handler.
Yeah, and I went over there, and he was all dressed in Rossi leathers.
Yeah.
And, I mean, like literally, like, head to toe in Rossi leathers, Rossi helmet, and, you know, with the sun and moon. Because I saw him down, and I saw him getting up, and I was like, oh, I didn't know Rossi was here. And on a Ducati, look at that. And I went over there, and we were helping out. Once it was obvious that he was okay, I said, yeah, I guess you should be getting the donkey helmet. And I think it was a little too early for that. Because he actually broke a peg off his rear set, which I'm sure is like...
$1,600 for a new peg.
Yep.
Yeah, throw something from Lockhart Phillips on it. Well, so and you had fun, and you did some onboard footage too.
Yeah, we excuse me, Adam Silva was there, and I brought my flip, and I was like my flip video, and I was gonna basically Velcro it or duct tape it to the bike, and he had a really nice little mount that he lent me, so I put that on the triple clamp and got about four sessions worth of video footage.
Cool.
So, and one of them was really fun because it was just after lunch, and I was riding around with this guy Chris Weir, who was on a KTM SMR 450, so totally underpowered compared to the 916. But man, he was just so much more capable in the corners. He's a really good rider. I saw him. His video of when he rode in R1 the same day in the B plus group, and he was fast, very fast guy. He knows how to ride really well, and we had a blast. We basically like diced for the entire session, and I made a little fun little 2 minute video that I'll link to from that. Definitely, my biggest problems were coming off over the hill, so T1, T2,
yeah.
Of course, the entry to the corkscrew. Very tentative.
That's what I was going to talk to you about. So The corkscrew is very unique, obviously, in racing, and everybody knows about it. The easiest way to do it, if you're in a track day mode, clearly I have no comprehension of a GP mode, but is to enter it. So it's got a really weird little twist there. So you come up the hill, and it's a really steep climb. If you enter it on a slow-ish bike, which both of ours are, you kind of want to stay to the left, and as you come up over the rise, and the rise is not as bad as it used to be, you want to kind of veer hard right, and that's when the bike will get light, and everything will lighten up, and that's right when you have to get on the brake. So it's a really tricky kind of entry. And then you want to end up on the far right and tilt it in really early, but be prepared to turn hard right before you can even see the bottom. And that's the weirdest thing about the corkscrew. It's another blind crest. You cannot see where you want to go until you're well into the corner. The shot you had from the video, I think you were doing fine. I think you were approaching that, but it looked a little tentative. But not something that you can't figure out over a series of n number of laps. And I thought you did well. You're laughing. I'm sitting here leaning my head.
Are you leaning the chair?
Yeah, I am. Well, the chair will not lean. It's a weird little track. You know, it looks really simple. If you laid it out flat on a piece on a table, you'd be like, oh, well, that's a piece you could get around. But it's not. It's got massive elevation changes. Running it on a track day is brilliant. You know, Heidi Kender has run it a few times. Lots of people that go there kind of expect it to be somewhat normal, and it's not. It's a weird track. And
it is, but you know what? It's also a track that spoils the hell out of you, especially now that it's been rebuilt for MotoGP.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't even imagine what it's going to be like going back to Thunder Hill and, you know, or Infineon and be like, oh, I got to deal with this concrete wall or this ditch or, you know, it's like, I really felt that, I mean, it's just a completely different level of track in terms of safety and quality.
Well, it certainly is a world-class track, and it's made leaps and bounds. And thank you, Yamaha, again, for a second week in a row, for contributing all that you have to put the track into shape. It is a world-class track. I mean, what can you say? It's a GP track. They put it up to FIM standards. Not to say that, you know, a couple of the other tracks that we get to run out here in California aren't fun, but, yeah, no, it kicks ass.
And I was dreaming about it for days afterwards. So, I mean, seriously, especially because this is the first time I've been to, so I've been going to Thunderhill and Infineon for the last, you know, six years. And it's like, you know, I go there knowing what I have to work on, whereas here was like, I had no idea what to expect. And yet, I'm a much better rider than I used to be when I started running at Thunderhill or Infineon. So I was pushing in some sections that felt very familiar, I was pushing, but then in other sections I was really feeling strange about the bike and how it's handling. I think I have no idea what I'm trying to say.
No, I actually totally understand what you're saying. There are Thunderhill and Infineon are tracks that are easy to come to grips with. Well, Infineon maybe not so much. Laguna Seca is one of those tracks that you cannot run for just a day and think you've even come friggin' close to grips with it.
Right.
It needs time, and it needs a lot of time. You know, guys that come out and want to run the national races or whatever, or the guys that come out and run wild cards in GP that have never run there before, they're baffled. And back in the World Superbike days, you know, you'd see guys come out and they'd wild cards that would be like, whoa, there's no way I can handle this. It is a world caliber track that has a ton of weird nuances to it. And you know, I hope it stays that way. It's got a ton of character.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. I like to see that we still have racetracks like this in the GP circuit, circus, because, there's way too many
guitars.
Computer designed tracks, you know.
Yeah. But God bless Alan Wilson, but you know, something that's 50 years old is pretty friggin' cool.
Yeah. Again, it was fantastic. Anybody who was there, I've already seen a couple of videos on YouTube from other people, including one guy who had a cameo in my one of my videos. Had a really neat video where he mounted like one of those little GoPros on the back of his bike facing him.
Oh, neat.
With a really wide angle view, so it's very MotoGP like.
Did he pull his leathers out of his butt?
No. That's what he should have done. It'd been great. And but anyway, a lot of cool people. I don't think anybody got hurt. There was a lot of crashes, and at the beginning of the day, we were warned there would be a lot of crashes because it is a very strange track. And by the end of the day, because Kegwin's the way they do stuff, they don't like to close the track down.
Yeah.
They did close it down at one point to bring an ambulance out for a guy, but as far as I know, he didn't actually need to be taken away or anything like that.
Yeah.
But there were so many bikes around the track by the end of the day. I would say at least 9 bikes, and they cleaned up at lunchtime, so, you know.
Mad props to Lance and Linda Kegwin when they put on an incredible track day. So
they really do. This is my second one with them this year, and I've never actually done a Kegwin before, and they're awesome.
Yeah, they're very, very cool. So what else, man?
That's it. That's it.
No. We got a little bit of World Superbike stuff going on.
Oh, okay. That's right. Yeah, we do.
So there's some kind of oddball things going on with Yamaha, which are frankly kind of disturbing. There was word last week, and we didn't talk about it because I was kind of holding off, that they were intended to withdraw World Supersport, direct World Supersport support for their teams. And, you know, not such a big deal. It's, you know, the bikes are still there. The engines are still there. The chassis are still there. But they're not throwing a bunch of money at it. Well, there is word that this week that if Ben Spies does win the title and migrates to MotoGP, which is still kind of, you know, up in the air, and we'll have to see how that works. And, you know, it appears that there may be a seat for the All-Texas team in Tech 3. That they may not even have a factory-supported World Superbike team. So that's a little scary.
That is, although I have to say that I'm not sure if that means that there will be no factory support, or maybe that the factory support will shift to a different team.
True, but I mean, it really is all about the money, isn't it, Jules? I mean, who's gonna get paid?
That's very true. But then again, they will not have to pay Ben's exorbitant salary either.
Okay, you have a point there. But I mean, what costs more? Paying Ben Spies or actually doing development on a brand new R1? Well, which has already been developed at this point. So
I think that it's close. You know, knowing from a year ago when that whole silly season with Ben Spies was going on, how much he was asking for a MotoGP ride per year, it's pretty high up there. I think that you can definitely run a very good team for Ben Spies' salary.
Yeah, I mean, if I had to guess, and probably going to email Tom Howsworth on this, going, no, you're totally wrong. I would bet that Yamaha spent more money, or Mary Spies. Yamaha probably spent a lot more money developing the R1 and throwing parts at it this year than they actually paid Ben.
That's true, but they were going to do that no matter who was writing it.
True. And then the question is, you know, we haven't even talked about Tom Sykes, Ben's teammate, because it's been kind of quiet this year. He hasn't had a horrible season, but it hasn't been great. And so where does he go? BSB, Moto2, who knows? But yeah, we've been really quiet on him because the focus has all been on Ben and your best friend, Nori.
Well, I think Nori should just go back to Yamaha and win the championship once Ben leaves, in that case.
That'd be way cool. Yeah, they have to paint it red again, or you wouldn't be happy. So that's something to think about. It's kind of a quiet season over there. You know, we've got a bit of a gap. And then there was some cool news. And I can't talk about AMA, but I'll kind of like creep over and I can just say former MotoGP rider Chaz Davies. Is that fair?
There you go.
Has signed up to run the remainder of World Superbike season with Park & Go BE1 Triumph, stepping from the RSV 1000, relatively archaic designed bike in the AMA, onto the 675 Triple, which has been doing pretty damn well this year, certainly under Gary McQuaid, the old King of Slide. And frankly, not so badly under Nannelli, who got ousted, and I'm guessing over some weird contract stuff, because he actually wasn't having that bad a season either. So that'll be fun to watch.
Definitely, definitely. Another speaking of big guys, another big guy.
Yeah, yeah, he's my height, so or nearly. And that's a podium capable bike. You know, Gary got on the box in Donington. Not even really in suspect conditions, and they've threatened a lot. And the cool thing is that, and so those people that are MotoGP OD fans, you know, we've talked to the Laverty brothers, we've talked to Chaz, all three of those guys are great friends. So the battle at the front should be one of those battles of friends. And I can see Chaz, even though all three of those tracks that we have remaining, Manicure, Imola and Portimao, he's never seen. I wouldn't be surprised if he did well, because he's proven this year in AMA in America that he can run really well on tracks he's never seen before. So it could be fun.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks, Jim. Have a good night.
You too.
Take care. Ciao.
Ciao.
Hello. This is Jules, and I'm with Adam Silver. We're at Laguna Seca. It's Friday the 11th.
September 9/11.
Had a little bit of a moment of silence this morning
at the riders' meeting,
and then we made up for it by
making a lot of noise. On a no sound limit track day at Laguna Seca, which is pretty rare.
Yeah.
So anyway,
so we're sitting inside of Adam's. What do you call this thing?
It's a VW Eurovan Weekender.
Right on. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about your trip to Europe. You went to Donington, and you were at the Day of Champions for Riders.
I was indeed. So, you know, I'm a big, heavy involved in Riders for Health, as some of you guys may know. We have a Northern California chapter for Riders for Health here in the Bay Area. And It's starting to get some traction. We got some new events that we're planning right now for the remainder of the year. And next year, we'll be focused on Day of Stars, which is the event at Laguna. But I took some time over the summer to go to the UK, and that's where the Riders for Health main office is. And I went down there the day before Day of Champions, which was probably like the worst day to go visit those people, because they're all running around trying to get ready. But I met all the people, all the staff at the office, and you know, it's a pretty extensive organization. And
how many people do they have at that office?
I don't know the exact number, but I'm going to guess that they have probably maybe 20 people that are focused on fundraising and administrative stuff, you know, finance and marketing communications and all that kind of stuff. And then they also have a team in the UK office that's basically focused on the logistics for the countries that they operate in African countries. And just to recap for those that don't know, Riders for Health is the charity that was co-founded by Randy Mamola about 20 years ago, and they operate programs in African countries that utilize motorcycles to deliver healthcare to remote villages and people that need healthcare.
So, and they make some killer videos.
And they make some killer videos, yeah. So it was a really interesting day when I went down to the office, and like I said, you know, I've had this kind of email relationship with a lot of these people there, and it was really, really great just to meet them and, you know, put names to faces, or faces to names, I should say. And, yeah, it was great. And then the following day, I went, oh, excuse me, yeah, I got my days muddled up. I was there 2 days before Day of Champions at the office, and then the following day was set-up day. So I went down to Donington, and I kind of tried to help them set everything up. And I was really kind of in an observing capacity because, you know, we had this event here at Laguna this year for Day of Stars, and it was a very different style of event than Day of Champions. And what I want to try and do is I want to try and bring some more of the Day of Champions type event to the American MotoGP races.
What's the number one difference? Is it like who gets to go?
Yeah, that's part of it. I mean, the thing to understand about Day of Champions in the UK is I think this year was its 20th year or 19th year or something like that. So it's been going for a really long time. And one of the things that just became immediately obvious is, first of all, they've got a really large pool of volunteers that come and, you know, work on stuff for the day, and it happens on the Thursday before the MotoGP weekend. And the thing that was amazing is all of the volunteers that I met knew exactly what they were going to do, and the reason they knew exactly what they were going to do is because they basically did the same thing in the previous year. So it's just one of these cumulative things, and a lot of the people in the motorcycling community and outside of the motorcycling community in the UK know about Day of Champions. It's kind of, you know, it's like the Queen's birthday, you know, it's like it's almost like a national event. And So, you know, and they've built that up over all these years and years and years. But let me tell you some more about the event itself, because it was just, it was a great event. I've got some videos that I'm going to post on YouTube, and I'll give you the link once I've posted them. So when you put this interview up, hopefully people can go on to the website and see the link. But basically, the format of the day, it's first of all, it's a full day event. People start showing up about 9 o'clock in the morning, and they've basically got like this whole massive parking lot area at Donington Park, and they've got a big stage set up. And you know, one of the key sort of things that happens during the day is James Toseland's band plays a number of sets throughout the day, and they're actually really, really good. And as you can imagine, you know, James Toseland is kind of the local hero in the UK, lots of people like him. And so they have that going on, and there's events going on the stage throughout the whole day. And they get Toby Moody and Julian Ryder come on and you know, talk about stuff. And they'll get a bunch of other, you know, well-known sort of motorcycle people that will be up there on the stage doing various different things throughout the day. But in that same area, they have a bunch of vendor booths set up. One of the things that Riders for Health in the UK has is a pretty good system throughout the year where they get motorcycle gear donated, either slightly used motorcycle gear, or sometimes, you know, they have good relationships with many of the magazines. So when the magazines do reviews of gear and they're done with the review, they give it to Riders for Health, and then so they've got this big kind of wardrobe, if you like, of helmets and leathers and gloves and boots and, you know, motorcycle
wear. Raffles and auctions.
Well, they have a store.
Oh, I see.
It's in the vendor area, so they just sell motorcycles.
But the money goes to the riders.
And all the money goes to Riders for Health, right? The other thing that they do is they have this, you know, helmet and leathers check, and they've actually got these big buses, and they've taken a bunch of old buses. I mean, in England they're called coaches, but it's a bus, as far as we're concerned. And they've converted them to be, you know, helmet, glove, boot, and leather storage.
Nice.
You know, and each one's... So you walk on the bus, and I actually interviewed one of the volunteers that was running one of the buses there, and they're parked in various places around Donington. So, you know, and it's £2 to, you know, have them store all your gear for the day, and all that money goes to riders. The other thing that they had, which I thought was just a blast, and I did it myself, is they have sidecar taxi rides.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, they've got a good relationship with the Sidecar Racing Association in the UK. And you don't actually get to go on the Donington track, but they have... Basically, they took a big, old, unused area of the parking lot, and they made a little track out of it, you know. And you hang on for dear life. And it's,
you get to be the monkey?
You get to be the monkey, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, so it's £20, and I paid £20. And, you know, one of the guys that took me around is an amateur, you know, but pretty, you know, well-qualified sidecar driver.
What was that?
It was bloody amazing. It was really, really good.
Cool.
And I've got some video clips of that as well.
Oh, excellent.
So not of actually the ride itself, but, you know, before and after.
Right.
Yeah, it was great. And what else was there? No, there was a whole bunch of stuff. And then, you know, the highlight of the day, somewhat similar to the Day of Stars, is the auction.
Yeah.
Which starts at 4 o'clock on the Thursday. And, yeah, it's difficult to communicate the magnitude of the event. I mean, you know, you've got Toby Moody and Julian Ryder up there basically running the auction. But they also have a professional auctioneer that, you know, once Toby and Julian have talked to the riders and kind of described what the items are that are for sale, they hand it off to the auctioneer to actually do the auctioning, and it was incredibly effective. And you got to imagine, you know, you're up on this massive stage where, you know, James Toseland's band has just been performing, and I would guess that there were probably maybe 2,800 people in the audience. I mean, wow. So it almost seemed to me like there were like 3,000 people there.
Wow.
And throughout the day, we had little spots of rain on and off, on and off. I mean, there was one set where Crash played, and it was actually pretty much coming down pretty hard, but they still played on, and it was great. And I had, because I was, you know, connected with riders, I had the opportunity to kind of be backstage and see how they processed, you know, how they got the riders to come in and sign all of the items that have been donated for auction. And I was there when Rossi came in, and it was really funny because, you know, I mean, you can imagine Valentino Rossi, like, it's, well, not tight security, but everyone is really sort of concerned, to wants to make sure that he can kind of get in and get out without getting too hassled. And even though we were in sort of the backstage area, it was still pretty crazy because a few people had come through and whatever.
But they basically they had every single rider go up on stage.
They did.
At one point.
They basically did have every single MotoGP rider go up on stage and donate something. I think for me personally, the highlight of the day was, you know, at the end of Rossi being up there. He, you know, they'd auctioned off all of the things, you know, and they auctioned off R125S Yamaha, which is like little 125 version of an R1. No, you can't get them here. It's a great little bike. And Rossi signed it, and you know, they auctioned off there were loads of pictures and other things that got auctioned off. And right at the very end, you know, as Toby Moody's wrapping up the sort of on stage bit with Rossi. Rossi takes off his cap. He's wearing his yellow cap, and he says, "You know, I wanna have you guys auction off this cap." And so Toby Moody says to him, "Well, you know, tell us about the cap." And he said, "Well, this is the cap I've worn for the last three races." And he pointed inside and he said, "It even has some dirt, you know, on the inside." And he described it. I've got this all on video, so if people want to check it out. Anyway, they got £2,200 for the cap, which is about $3,500,
right.
Something like that. It was amazing. Amazing.
What was it? You guys raised a ridiculous amount of money.
So on that one day, with the auction plus the entrance fee. So the entrance fee for Day of Champions, there's two choices. You can either pay £15 just to get in, which is the basic entrance, which is about, you know, $40. Or you can pay £25, which I think, what does that entail? It entitles you to something extra. I think you can get to do a parade lap around the track or something. That was the other thing they had, a parade lap, a couple of parade laps. I mean, that's very different to Day of Stars, right? So with the entrance fees and with the money they got from the auction, they raised just over $300,000 in that one day.
Yeah. Dollars?
Or? Dollars.
Okay.
It was about 202,000 euros. Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, so it was just an unbelievable day. I mean, it was really just totally, totally cool, and it was a great way to kind of kick off the MotoGP weekend in the UK.
I want to ask you about the race, but before that, like, that amount of money, what is that going to do for the actual riders' organization?
To be very honest with you, I'm not quite sure exactly how they provision, you know, how they use all the money, but...
They do have that on the website. Like,
yeah, actually, that's true, that's true. If you go to the riders.org website, it breaks down for you very nicely, you know, this amount of money will buy a motorcycle and will, you know, allow us to run it for a year, et cetera, et cetera, but... You know, specifically, where did that $300,000 that was raised at Day of Champions go? I don't actually know.
They could finance, you know, like 1,000 bikes. Not 1,000 bikes, but 100 bikes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With the entire mechanic setup, everything like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is crazy.
It is pretty crazy, yeah, it's amazing. And, you know, when you think that they're now running about, I think they've got almost 2,000 motorcycles in operation in 5 different African countries. And those 2,000 motorcycles provide healthcare to 13 million people, which is an unbelievable number of people. So, you know, they really get good bang for the buck with this organization. So it's a great organization. So I want to tell you a bit about the race weekend as well.
Please.
Have you got any other things you want to talk about?
No, I was going to say, I want to hear...
Just to wrap up on Day of Champions, I mean, you know, I was there kind of in awe of what the UK organization do, and just made me realize that, you know, we've got such a lot of work to do in the US.
It's only the third year, right?
It is only the third year. Yeah. So, you know, but I think it could be fantastic here.
The event at Indy was actually really good.
Right, I heard really that. I wasn't at Indy, unfortunately, but, you know, and everything I've heard is that Indy is potentially the opportunity to more closely replicate what they do with Day of Champions in the UK. So, you know, these things take time, you know, and Andrea Coleman, who runs Riders for Health, you know, keeps reminding me, you know, it took us 20 years to get to where we are with Day of Champions in the UK, but I'm ambitious and I'd love to, you know, do some great stuff. So let me tell you about the race we did.
Yeah, please.
So I was really fortunate because Riders gave me access. Their staff actually get a very limited number of, like, the most premier VIP passes, and they had one available that I was able to use, and I was able to use it, and then I gave it back and stuff like that. But it was totally cool because I got to go right into the, you know, kind of exclusive area where all the motorhomes are.
Right.
And you know, it's very different to the MotoGP at Laguna, because a lot of, I mean, MotoGP in general, I would say, is, generally speaking, is more European-based, right? A lot of the teams are most of the teams are European-based. And so, you know, they all drive their, you know, the complete rigs with,
right,
you know, the trucks, massive trucks.
And yeah.
You know, and I took some photographs of, you know, just this row of trucks in the paddock. And it's just unbelievable, just checking it all out. And I got to spend time hanging out quite a bit, actually, with Randy, which was just completely cool. He did his two up rides, mm-hmm. And on the Saturday, I think, he actually took Prince Harry for a two up ride, which was like a really big deal in England.
Yeah, Sharon posted some photos of that on Facebook.
Yeah. And it was a very hush hush thing before the event, and I guess, by virtue of the fact that, you know, he's wearing a helmet, you know, all the people in the crowd didn't even know it was Prince Harry, but I guess they announced it afterwards. So anyway, and of course, you know, Prince Harry's aunt, Princess Anne, is the patron of Riders for Health, so he's very aware of the work of Riders. But I think for me, one of the highlights of the weekend was, I think it was on the Friday evening, I was with Randy and a couple of other folks that Randy knows who are big fans. And Randy actually took us into the Tech 3 garage while all the bikes were there, and kind of gave us a pretty good overview of how the teams are run and a whole bunch of stuff. And he spent a lot of time actually talking about Moto 2. Yeah, so the thing that was interesting is, you know, as I personally had been following Moto 2, I was kind of lukewarm on the whole thing. And but
we just talked about this this week. It's turning out to be really exciting.
Well, you know, Randy Mamola's eyes just lit up when he started talking about Moto 2. He is very, very excited about it. And, you know, he said that he hopes, or what he was saying is that the way that the whole business with the spec motor could go is he basically said, look, what could happen is, and I don't follow Formula 1, so you've got to forgive me a little bit, but what could happen is they publish the, I guess, the blueprints for building a spec motor, and then lots of different companies potentially could build spec motors. But they're
so
all, they
it's
all
not just Honda providing the actual.
Right, exactly, thing. Exactly. Yeah. So he's looking into the future, thinking maybe if that happens, then, you know, that could make things a little more, well, not a little more interesting, because he was like super excited, and he's like, just imagine, because he'd ridden one of the Moto 2 bikes, and he was telling us about how it was to ride, and he was just pretty jazzed about it. And he said, you know, they just rev and they just scream so loud. And he said, you know, the grid is going to be a big grid. It's going to be like 35 riders. And just imagine the sound of 35 of these things on the grid, you know, doing a start. It's going to be insane. So he was really pumped up about Moto 2. So that was really a lot of fun, you know, getting to get that kind of private tour of the garage with Randy. It was really, really cool. And he's a super neat guy. And
yeah.
Just always bubbling full of energy and just a fun guy to hang out with. So.
Totally. And the races?
Races were great. I mean, kind of weird,
yeah.
Of course. Again, one of the nice things about riders is, you know, the Riders for Health folks know all the people at the track, and I guess there was a suite at Donington that hadn't been rented out, so they let the Riders for Health people use it. So we got to be at a suite right on Craner Curves, which was fantastic.
Oh, man.
And, nice. You know, it was kind of a weird race.
Yeah.
You know, what can you say? The weather was just completely unpredictable, which is like the worst possible weather for a MotoGP race. You know, teams don't know which tyres to use. And
well, obviously one team didn't.
Yeah, well, the Ducati guys took a gamble and just completely lost. But I mean, it was great being there, obviously. It was really cool because the suite we were in, you know, we had this balcony looking out on Craner Curves. We're on the infield of Craner Curves. But we also had the live TV feed inside the suite. So when the bikes came by, we were all out on the balcony, and then we'd all run inside and watch the rest of the lap on the TV, and then we'd go outside. Because, you know, one of the problems with watching a live race is you don't get the same coverage as you do on TV, but we kind of had the best of both worlds, so it was totally a cool experience. You know, the 250s and the 125s were pretty cool too. I mean, Ayama was just unbelievable in the 250 race. It was really cool. Oh, the other thing that was brilliant was sorry, I'm getting into English now. Doesn't mean that it's shiny. Brilliant means it's cool.
We get it now.
Awesome.
We've been with you guys for a while.
Thank you. Barry Coleman, who's Andrew's husband, who's the other guy that runs Riders for Health. He in his previous life he was actually a moto journalist, and so again, you know, hanging out with Andrea and Barry is just amazing because they know absolutely everybody at the track because they've just, it's been their lives, you know. So Barry took me aside, I think it was on the Saturday, and he said, hey, come with me. So I walked with him, and we walked into the, he took me into the commentary box where they do the commentary from for the track.
Oh, man.
And the guy, the track commentator, whose name escapes me, has obviously known Barry for ages and ages, and this guy knows absolutely every single fact about every single team. I mean, he's doing the track announcing, and he's talking about, oh yeah, and the sponsor, and you know, all the 125 teams and the 250 teams. I think we were up there during the 250 free practice, and you know, he's talking about the riders and he's talking about the bikes, and then he starts talking about, you know, the sponsors. And he's like, oh yeah, and this company that sponsors this rider, you know, they're in this industry and they just got acquired by this company. And it's just like unbelievable amount of data that this guy has in his head while he's commentating. And I want to say his name was Fred Clark or John Clark. Anyway, whatever.
Well, when you find out, shoot me an email. I'll correct it.
Thank you. So that was really a lot of fun as well, because, you know, when you're up in the commentary booth, it's basically like a greenhouse building, and you can see the whole track pretty much. So that was just, and I just hung out there listening to the guy doing the commentary for a while, and it was really, really good.
So what was the fact that this was the last time we had Donington for a while? Was there like a kind of farewell type feeling?
I didn't really pick that up.
No.
I didn't really pick that up.
A lot of riders talked about it that way,
but
it's just a race, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what it is. It's just a race, and everyone's focused on doing their job on that day, and, you know, it'll be next year at Silverstone, it'll be interesting. I mean, I like Silverstone. I think it's a pretty cool track, too, so.
Cool. All right, I think you may be missing your session.
Yeah, I probably am, but it's okay. I wanted to get this done. I'm sacrificing myself for MotoGPOD, so that's okay, because we've had a good morning so far.
Yeah.
I did a 1:46 in my last session, which, for, you know, for an old slow guy, is not that bad. Just got, like, 25 seconds until I can get up to Valentino Rossi in Casey Stoner's time, but that's never going to happen. So, anyway. So, good.
All right, thanks, man.
You're welcome.
Cheers.